Buddha, Dharma, the Sangha. I want to speak of Sangha today. Forgiveness, self-forgiveness, contrition. I want to try to view it from a little different angle, at least to start with, than we usually do. Just ask the simple and rather not too bright question, if we do Sangha, what's in it for the eternal? Like I say, not a very smart question. In fact, you know, since I'm the origin, I came up with the question. I can say this. I wouldn't say it. Someone else's question. That's a really stupid question. Well, let's just, maybe sometimes from not very smart beginnings, we can go somewhere helpful. What is in it for the eternal? Well, there's not only no selfishness, there's no possibility of selfishness in the eternal. Let's kind of click on one of the views that we can have of the eternal. And in that view, the eternal is just infinite, unconditional love, such as we can never understand, fathom, or imagine, really, because it is infinite. It is utterly unconditional. Well, what's in it for love like that, that we should do Sangha? Well, a love like that, first of all, it never judges. It loves, its love is the same towards everyone and everything, every event, every aspect of existence. It's incapable of differentiating. So from one point of view, you could say, well, it doesn't matter to the eternal, to that love, what we are, what we do. But that love is not a blind love. It is, the wisdom is an infinite as well as the love. And an infinitely wise love knows the way in which that which it loves can hurt itself, and knows it completely right down to the ground in every detail. So if it is our sincere wish for full recognized reunion with the eternal, with that infinite love and infinite wisdom, will it not help that which it loves with an infinite love to succeed in this? And that's what's in it for the eternal. an infinite love. Does that which is in the very best interest, and always does that which is in the very best interest. Remember, it's infinitely wise as well as infinitely loving of the beloved. And if it is our sincere wish and our longing for full recognized reunion, for full reharmonization with itself, then it is going to help us do that. Sangha comes about as one of the main aspects of this coming together, of the coming together, of our sincere wish expressed in our sincere training, and that infinite love and infinite wisdom. And in How to Grow Lotus Blossom, you have portrayed there Sangha at the deepest level. In every deep retreat, I always use the term, or think the term, naturally arising retreat. Such as that is portrayed in How to Grow a Lotus Blossom. You have a daily rhythm. There are times in which a person is drawn into the deepest meditation. There is a time at which generally other times, and when drawn into the deepest meditation, when if what is good to happen is that there be a review of one's life, this review is shown or unscrolls before one bit by bit. To what end? We need to know with full clarity what are those things that create disharmony of our body and mind with the eternal, that create the illusion of a separation from our true nature. It's only ever an illusion, but when you buy into an illusion, the illusion can be a very convincing thing and get very stuck. So we're shown from our own experience. What better way to learn than from one's own experience? And this scrolling out from the past can go seamlessly back into past lives, where we see the kinds of choices that produce the big karmic jangles. course, as one sees in How Good Is a Lotus Blossom, this can be a very painful process. River Master, some of the visions that you see illustrated in How Good Is a Lotus Blossom, you see demonic figures, seemingly demonic figures, forcing her to admit to things. These are understood in Buddhism as the servants of the eternal, not as evil beings. And as in all the visions, all you have to do is put a simple like this, plug in a simple like this to see what the teaching is. The difficulty of looking at some things and of admitting them and accepting them, and the forcefulness which it is pressed upon us that we need to do this at all costs, whatever the difficulty and pain, is like we're being choked. Manhandled by monstrous beings. It is like this, it feels like this. To some people, they will experience it visually like this. Some people, perhaps not. But the point of those illustrations is to get the teaching apart across. The point of the visions, as Reverend Master herself emphasized, is to get the teaching across. A picture is worth a thousand words, it is said. And it does get the point across very graphically. Undergoing such a process is, yes, very painful. But a person who's gotten that far sees the kindness in the process and works very hard not to kick against it. Being human and being, and given the difficulty of going through it, we're sometimes less than perfect in how we first handle the next wave as it hits. And when one's going through this, one never knows what's coming next. You think, well, there can't be much more that's that difficult, and then get something which is much more difficult. Again, staying rooted in meditation, looking up, as River Master put it very simply, trust as you have never trusted before in your life. Really that simple. And one knows in that place of the deepest trust that one cannot be hurt in the true sense. One is rooted in that which is indestructible, and to which no external things matter. When we read Rim Master's commentary on the precepts, we see the result in teaching of the deepest Sangha. Where is the focus? First of all, as you read precept by precept, what you see over and over again is, when I violate this precept, I hurt myself. How do I hurt myself? I create clouds in a clear sky. I blind myself to the true reality of the immaculacy and I fall into the opposite of good and evil, right and wrong. And if I keep falling into them, then I harden my heart against evil, and I clutch after that which I view as good. And you, here you have the roots of hatred and greed. If I continue down such a path, I so smudge my spiritual glasses that I put a film of doubt over everything and skepticism. And here you have the root of delusion. And why am I doing that? Because I feel unclean and unworthy the more I go down the non-perceptual path. And I live more and more under the weight of self-judgment without necessarily even knowing I'm doing it. What is the other great emphasis in Rim Master's commentary on the precepts? Again, flowing naturally out of a profound Sangha. I must take refuge in the Lord of the house. When I fail to do that, when I forget to do that, the old karma acts upon me, and I go with it. Rim Master emphasized, and this is again just pure Soto Zen, because the direct implication of this emphasis is that one must always keep one's training up. The training and enlightenment truly are indivisible. But she always emphasized that our past karma can always potentially act upon us no matter how far we go. In training. As soon as we drop our vigilance, as soon as we get complacent, we can trip up big time. This is why she says things like, always I must check with the Lord of the house. Always I must ask the Lord of the house. She's not talking about if I want to extra carrots at supper, I need to check with the Lord of the house. Words can be a big help in teaching, and words are limited. And we all bring our experience and our present level of spiritual training and understanding to the words that teachers use. What Reverend Master was trying to get at when she talked about always asking is based in something that she had been doing for so long, and she had had so drummed into her in her retreat and in that great Sangha. That it would be, understandably, very difficult to imagine all the ways that people might get confused about something that was so obvious to her. What she was talking about was something that cannot be separated from keeping one's mind and heart fixed upon the eternal through pure meditation. Above everything else, Reverend Master was a magnificent meditator. Asking, offering, listening, waiting, following, these are aspects of meditation. What is meditation? Understood, the deepest level. It is just simply holding fast to the Lord of the house. While sitting on a cushion in the midst of our daily life, what is it we keep coming back to? Just this present moment. What is the true nature of this present moment? It is unborn, uncreated, undying, indestructible, immaculate, empty, void of self. If I turn towards Lord of the house and ask, what is it that is good for me to do here? In this situation, with this problem, what is it that is good for me to do? Please help. You can't divorce that from meditation. It would never have occurred to her master to divorce that from meditation. Meditation provides the context, the asking, the offering, the waiting, the listening, the following, all of which are in her commentary and the precepts. Those are just aspects, points that as we proceed in the meditation, as the meditation flows naturally forward from moment to moment, one aspect or the other sometimes lights up. This is a part of practice that cannot be, must not be willfully externalized, turned into some kind of formula. Because every time you try to grasp after something in that way, and that's the only reason why we would do that, we're doing something other than meditating. The aspects are only aspects. The meditation is the constant context. What we learn in the Sangha, in a real school of hard knocks, is how important both context and aspects are. And what their religious ground is, the Lord of the house, the eternal. This is why Rumi Master called her first book, Zen is Eternal Life. Zen is meditation. What meditation really is the life of Buddha, unborn and undying. What we call the practice of meditation is a window into this true life, which we all have, a doorway into it. But until we've done a great deal of training, at least part of us feels very separate from it. True Sangha really helps dissolve the illusion of that separation. And as I have said so many times before, and as Rumi Master so often emphasized, the knots, jangles of self-judgment the things we're holding against ourselves are the ultimate blocks that the Sangha is working upon. The precepts flow naturally from Sangha. Out of the realization that we can just go out and make a mess again. We need to walk with confidence and with faith and also carefully. Reflectively. With due consideration for the potential consequences of our actions. In Sangha we have learned how extreme, how painful some of those consequences can be. And in the deepest Sangha, we can see how they can roll down the centuries and the lifetimes. This is why the precepts were always said by Reverend Master and have always been viewed in Soto Zen as the lifeblood of the Buddhas.